hiker named Scott Grierson set off within 2 days of each other. Horton had a network of support crews waiting at road crossings and other strategic points, and so needed to carry nothing but a bottle of water. Each evening, he was taken by car to a motel or private home. He averaged 38.3 miles a day, with 10 or 11 hours of running. Grierson, meanwhile, merely walked, but he did so for as much as 18 hours a day. Horton finally overtook Grierson in New Hampshire on the 39th day, reaching his goal in 52 days, 9 hours. Grierson came in a couple of days later. All kinds of people have completed through hikes. One man hiked it in his 80s. Another did it on crutches. A blind man named Bill Irwin hiked the trail with a seeing eye dog, falling down an estimated 5,000 times in the process. Probably the most famous, certainly the most written about, of all thru-hikers was Emma Grandma Gatewood, who successfully hiked the trail twice in her late 60s, despite being eccentric, poorly equipped, and a danger to herself. She was forever getting lost. My own favorite, however, is a guy named Woodrow Murphy from Pepperell, Massachusetts, who did a thru-hike in the summer of 1995. I would have liked him anyway, just for being called Woodrow. But I especially admired him when I read that he weighed 350 pounds and was doing the hike to lose weight. In his first week on the trail, he managed just 5 miles a day, but he persevered, and by August, when he reached his home state, he was up to 12 miles a day. He had lost 53 pounds, a trifle, all things considered. And at last report was considering doing it all over again the following year. A significant fraction of thru-hikers reach Katahdin, then turn around and start back to Georgia. They just can't stop walking, which kind of makes you wonder. In fact, the more you read about thru-hikers, the more you end up being filled with a kind of wonder. Take Bill Irwin, the blind man. After his hike, he said, "I never enjoyed the hiking part. It was something I felt compelled to do. It wasn't my choice." Or David Horton, the ultra-runner who set the speed record in 1991. By his own account, he became a mental and emotional wreck and spent most of the period crossing Maine weeping copiously. Well, then why do it? Even good old Earl Schaffer ended up as a recluse in the backwoods of Pennsylvania. I don't mean to suggest that hiking the AT drives you potty, just that it takes a certain kind of person to do it. And how did I feel about giving up the quest, when a granny in sneakers, a human beach ball named Woodrow, and over 3,990 others had made it to Katahdin? Well, pretty good, as a matter of fact. I was still going to hike the Appalachian Trail, I just wasn't going to hike all of it. Katz and I had already walked 500,000 steps, if you can believe it. It didn't seem altogether essential to do the other 4.5 million to get the idea of the thing. So we rode to Knoxville with our comical cab driver, acquired a rental car at the airport, and found ourselves, shortly after midday, heading north out of Knoxville through a half-remembered world of busy roads, dangling traffic signals, vast intersections, huge signs, and acre upon acre of shopping malls, gas stations, discount stores, muffler clinics, car lots, and all the rest. Even after a day in Gatlinburg, the transition was dazzling. I remember reading once how some Stone Age Indians from the Brazilian rainforest, with no knowledge or expectation of a world beyond the jungle, were taken to Sao Paulo or Rio, and when they saw what it contained, the buildings, the cars, the passing airplanes, and how thoroughly at variance it was with their own simple lives, they wet themselves, lavishly and in unison. I believe I had some idea how they felt. It is such a strange contrast. When you're on the AT, the forest is your universe, infinite and entire. It is all you experience day after day. Eventually, it is about all you can imagine. You are aware, of course, that somewhere over the horizon there are mighty cities, busy factories, crowded freeways. But here in this part of the country, where woods drape the landscape for as far as the eye can see, the forest rules. Even the little towns like Franklin and Hiawassee and even Gatlinburg are just way stations scattered helpfully through the great cosmos of woods. but come off the trail, properly off, and drive somewhere, as we did now, and you realize how magnificently deluded you have been. Here, the mountains and woods were just backdrop, familiar, known, nearby, but no more consequential and noticed than the clouds that scudded across their ridgelines. Here the real business was up close and on top of you. Gas stations, Walmarts, Kmarts, Dunkin' Donuts, Blockbuster Videos, a ceaseless unfolding pageant of commercial hideousness. Even Katz was unnerved by it.
Jeez, it's ugly,
he breathed in wonder, as if he had never witnessed such a thing before. I looked past him, along the line of his shoulder, to a vast shopping mall with a prairie-sized parking lot, and agreed, it was horrible. And then, lavishly and in unison, we wet ourselves. Chapter 10 There is a painting by Asher Brown Durand called Kindred Spirits, which is often reproduced in books when the subject turns to the American landscape in the 19th century. Painted in 1849, it shows two men standing on a rock ledge in the Catskills in one of those sublime lost world settings that look as if they would take an expedition to reach, though the two figures in the painting are dressed, incongruously, as if for the office, in long coats and plump cravats. Below them, in a shadowy chasm, a stream dashes through a jumble of boulders. Beyond, glimpsed through a canopy of leaves, is a long view of gorgeously forbidding blue mountains. To right and left, jostling into frame, are disorderly ranks of trees, which immediately vanish into consuming darkness. I can't tell you how much I would like to step into that view. The scene is so manifestly untamed, so full of an impenetrable beyond, as to present a clearly foolhardy temptation. You would die out there for sure, shredded by a cougar, or thudded with a tomahawk, or just left to wander to a stumbling, confounded death. You can see that at a glance. But never mind. Already you are studying the foreground for a way down to the stream over the steep rocks, and wondering if that notch ahead will get you through to the neighboring valley. Farewell, my friends. Destiny calls. Don't wait supper. Nothing like that view exists now, of course. Perhaps it never did. Who knows how much license these romantic Johnnies took with their stabbing paintbrushes? Who, after all, is going to struggle with an easel and camp stool and box of paints to some difficult overlook on a hot July afternoon in a wilderness filled with danger and not paint something exquisite and grand? But even if the pre-industrialized Appalachians were only half as wild and dramatic as in the paintings of Durand and others like him, they must have been something to behold. It is hard to imagine now how little known, how full of possibility, the world beyond the eastern seaboard once was. When Thomas Jefferson sent Lewis and Clark into the wilderness, he confidently expected them to find woolly mammoths and mastodons. Had dinosaurs been known, he would almost certainly have asked them to bring him a triceratops. The first people to venture deep into the woods from the east, the Indians, of course, had got there perhaps as much as 20,000 years before them. Weren't looking for prehistoric creatures or passages to the west or new lands to settle. They were looking for plants. America's botanical possibilities excited Europeans inordinately, and there was both glory and money to be made out in the woods. The eastern woods teemed with flora unknown to the old world, and there was a huge eagerness, from scientist and amateur enthusiast alike, to get a piece of it. Imagine if tomorrow a spaceship found a jungle growing beneath the gassy clouds of Venus. Think what Bill Gates, say, would pay for some tendrilled, purply lobed piece of Venusian exotica to put in a pot in his greenhouse. That was the rhododendron in the 18th century. And the camellia, the hydrangea, the wild cherry, the rudbeckia, the azalea, the aster, the ostrich fern, the catalpa, the spice bush, the Venus flytrap, the Virginia creeper, the euphorbia. These and hundreds more were collected in the American woods, shipped across the ocean to England and France and Russia, and received with greedy keenness and trembling fingers. It started with John Bartram. Actually, it started with tobacco, but in a scientific sense, it started with John Bartram, a Pennsylvania Quaker, born in 1699, who grew interested in botany after reading a book on the subject and began sending seeds and cuttings to a fellow Quaker in London. Encouraged to seek out more, he embarked on increasingly ambitious journeys into the wilderness, sometimes traveling over 1,000 miles through the rugged mountains. Though he was entirely self-taught, never learned Latin, and had scant understanding of Linnaean classifications, he was a prize plant collector with an uncanny knack for finding and recognizing unknown species. Of the 800 plants discovered in America in the colonial period, Bartram was responsible for about a quarter. His son William found many more. Before the century was out, the eastern woods were fairly crawling with botanists. Peter Kalm, Lars Jungstrom, Constantine Samuel Raffinesque Schmaltz, John Fraser, André Michaud, Thomas Nuttall, John Lyon, and others pretty much beyond counting. There were so many people out there, hunting so competitively, that it is often not possible to say with any precision who discovered what. Depending on which source you consult, Fraser found either 44 new plants or 215, or something in between. One of his uncontested discoveries was the fragrant southern balsam, the Fraser fir, so characteristic of the high ranges of North Carolina and Tennessee. But it bears his name only because he scrambled to the top of Clingman's Dome just ahead of his keen rival, Michaud. These people covered astonishing sweeps for considerable periods. One of the younger Bartram's expeditions lasted over 5 years and plunged him so deeply into the woods that he was long given up for lost. When he emerged, he discovered that America had been at war with Britain for a year, and he had lost his patrons. Michaud's voyages took him from Florida to Hudson's Bay. The heroic Nuttall ventured as far as the shores of Lake Superior, going much of the way on foot for want of funds. They often collected in prodigious, not to say rapacious, quantities. Lyon pulled 3,600 Magnolia macrophylla saplings from a single hillside, and thousands of plants more, including a pretty red thing that left him in a fevered delirium and covered almost in one continued blister all over his body. He had found, it turned out, poison sumac. In 1765, John Bartram discovered a particularly lovely camellia, Franklinia ultimaja. Already rare, it was hunted to extinction in just 25 years. Today it survives only in cultivation, thanks entirely to Bartram. Raffinesque Schmaltz, meanwhile, spent 7 years wandering through the Appalachians, didn't discover much, but brought in 50,000 seeds and cuttings. How they managed it is a wonder. Every plant had to be recorded and identified, its seeds collected or a cutting taken. If the latter, it had to be potted up in stiff paper or sailcloth, kept watered and tended, and somehow transported through a trackless wilderness to civilization. The privations and perils were constant and exhausting. Bears, snakes, and panthers abounded. Michaud's son was severely mauled on one expedition when a bear charged him from the trees. Black bears seem to have been notably more ferocious in former times. Nearly every journal has accounts of sudden, unprovoked attacks. It seems altogether likely that eastern bears have become more retiring because they have learned to associate humans with guns. Indians, too, were commonly hostile, though just as often bemused at finding European gentlemen carefully collecting and taking away plants that grew in natural abundance. And then there were all the diseases of the woods, like malaria and yellow fever. "I can't find one friend that will bear the fatigue to accompany me in my peregrinations," John Bartram complained wearily in a letter to his English patron. Hardly surprising. But evidently it was worth it. A single, particularly valued seed could fetch up to 5 guineas. On one trip, John Lyon cleared 900 lire after expenses, a considerable fortune, then returned the next year and made nearly as much again. Fraser made one long trip under the sponsorship of Catherine the Great of Russia, and emerged from the wilderness only to find that there was a new czar who had no interest in plants, thought he was mad, and refused to honor his contract. So Fraser took everything to Chelsea, where he had a little nursery, and made a good living selling azaleas, rhododendrons, and magnolias to the English gentry. Others did it for the simple joy of finding something new. None more admirably than Thomas Nuttall, a bright but unschooled journeyman printer from Liverpool who came to America in 1808 and discovered an unexpected passion for plants. He undertook two long expeditions, which he paid for out of his own pocket, made many important discoveries, and generously gave to the Liverpool Botanic Gardens plants that might have made him rich. In just 9 years, from a base of zero, he became the leading authority on American plants. In 1817, he produced, literally, for he not only wrote the text but set most of the type himself, the seminal Genera of North American Plants, which stood for the better part of a century as the principal encyclopedia of American botany. 4 years later, he was named curator of the Botanic Garden at Harvard University, a position he held with distinction for a dozen years, and somehow also found time to become a leading authority on birds, producing a celebrated text on American ornithology in 1832. He was, by all accounts, a kindly man who gained the esteem of everyone who met him. Stories don't get a great deal better than that. Already in Nuttall's day, the woods were being transformed. The panthers, elk, and timber wolves were being driven to extinction, the beaver and bear nearly so. The great first-growth white pines of the North Woods, some of them 220 feet high, that's the height of a 20-story building, had mostly been felled to make ships' masts or simply cleared away for farmland, and nearly all the rest would go before the century was out. Everywhere, there was a kind of recklessness born of a sense that the American woods was effectively inexhaustible. 200-year-old pecan trees were commonly chopped down just to make it easier to harvest the nuts on their topmost branches. With each passing year, the character of the woods changed perceptibly. But until quite recent times, painfully recent times, one thing remained in abundance that preserved the primeval, super-Eden feel of the original forest, the massively graceful American chestnut. There has never been a tree like it. Rising 100 feet from the forest floor, its soaring boughs spread out in a canopy of incomparable lushness, an acre of leaves per tree, a million or so in all. Though only half the height of the tallest eastern pines, the chestnut had a weight and mass and symmetry that put it in another league. At ground level, a full-sized tree would be 10 feet through its bole, more than 20 feet around. I have seen a photograph taken at the start of this century of people picnicking in a grove of chestnuts not far from where Katz and I now hiked, in an area known as the Jefferson National Forest. It is a happy Sunday party, all of the picnickers in heavy clothes, the ladies with clasped parasols, the men with bowler hats and walrus mustaches, all handsomely arrayed on a blanket in a clearing, against a backdrop of steeply slanting shafts of light and trees of unbelievable grandeur. The people are so tiny, so preposterously out of scale to the trees around them, as to make you wonder for a moment if the picture has been manipulated as a kind of joke, like those old postcards that show watermelons as big as barns, or an ear of corn that entirely fills a wagon under the droll legend, "A typical Iowa farm scene." But this is simply the way it was. The way it was over tens of thousands of square miles of hill and cove from the Carolinas to New England. And it is all gone now. In 1904, a keeper at the Bronx Zoo in New York noticed that the zoo's handsome chestnuts had become covered in small orange cankers of an unfamiliar type. Within days, they began to sicken and die. By the time scientists identified the source as an Asian fungus called Endothea parasitica, probably introduced with a shipment of trees or infected lumber from the Orient, the chestnuts were dead, and the fungus had escaped into the great sprawl of the Appalachians, where one tree in every four was a chestnut. For all its mass, a tree is a remarkably delicate thing. All of its internal life exists within three paper-thin layers of tissue— the phloem, xylem, and cambium, just beneath the bark, which together form a moist sleeve around the dead heartwood. However tall it grows, a tree is just a few pounds of living cells thinly spread between roots and leaves. These three diligent layers of cells perform all the intricate science and engineering needed to keep a tree alive, and the efficiency with which they do it is one of the wonders of life. Without noise or fuss, every tree in a forest lifts massive volumes of water, several hundred gallons in the case of a large tree on a hot day, from its roots to its leaves, where it is returned to the atmosphere. Imagine the din and commotion, the clutter of machinery that would be needed for a fire department to raise a similar volume of water. And lifting water is just one of the many jobs that the phloem, xylem, and cambium perform. They also manufacture lignin and cellulose, regulate the storage and production of tannin, sap, gum, oils, and resins, dole out minerals and nutrients, convert starches into sugars for future growth, which is where maple syrup comes into the picture, and goodness knows what else. But because all this is happening in such a thin layer, it also leaves the tree terribly vulnerable to invasive organisms. To combat this, trees have formed elaborate defense mechanisms. The reason a rubber tree seeps latex when cut is that this is its way of saying to insects and other organisms, "Not tasty, nothing here for you, go away." Trees can also deter destructive creatures like caterpillars by flooding their leaves with tannin, which makes the leaves less tasty and so inclines the caterpillars to look elsewhere. When infestations are particularly severe, some trees can even communicate the fact. Some species of oak release a chemical that tells other oaks in the vicinity that an attack is underway. In response, the neighboring oaks step up their tannin production the better to withstand the coming onslaught. By such means, of course, does nature tick along. The problem arises when a tree encounters an attacker for which evolution has left it unprepared, and seldom has a tree been more helpless against an invader than the American chestnut against Endothea parasitica. It enters a chestnut effortlessly, devours the cambium cells, and positions itself for attack on the next tree before the tree has the faintest idea, chemically speaking, what hit it. It spreads by means of spores which are produced in the hundreds of millions in each canker. A single woodpecker can transfer a billion spores on one flight between trees.
At the height of the American chestnut blight, every woodland breeze would lose spores in uncountable trillions to drift in a pretty, lethal haze onto neighboring hillsides. The mortality rate was 100%. In just over 35 years, the American chestnut became a memory. The Appalachians alone lost 4 billion trees, a quarter of its cover, in a generation. A great tragedy, of course. But how lucky, when you think about it, that these diseases are at least species-specific. Instead of a chestnut blight, or Dutch elm disease, or dogwood anthracnose, what if it was just a tree blight, something indiscriminate and unstoppable that swept through whole forests? In fact, there is. It's called acid rain. But let's stop there. I think we've both had enough science for one chapter. But hold that thought, please, and bear it in mind when I tell you that there wasn't a day in the Appalachian woods when I didn't give passing thanks for what there was. So the forest through which Katz and I pass now was nothing like the forest that was known even to the people of my father's generation, but at least it was a forest. It was splendid, in any case, to be enveloped once more in our familiar surroundings. It was in every detectable respect the same forest that we had left in North Carolina, same violently slanted trees, same narrow brown path, same expansive silence, broken only by our tiny grunts and labored breaths as we struggled up hills that proved to be as steep, if not quite as lofty, as those we had left behind. But, curiously, though we had come a couple of 100 miles north, spring seemed further advanced here. The trees, predominantly oak, were more fully in bud, and there were occasional clumps of wildflowers, bloodroot and trillium, and Dutchman's breeches, rising through the carpet of last year's leaves. Sunlight filtered through the branches overhead, throwing spotlights on the path, and there was a certain distinctive, heady spring lightness in the air. We took off first our jackets and then our sweaters. The world seemed altogether a genial place. Best of all, there were views, luscious and golden, to left and right. For 400 miles through Virginia, the Blue Ridge is essentially a long, single fin, only a mile or two wide, notched here and there with deep, V-shaped passes called gaps, but otherwise holding generally steady at about 3,000 feet, with the broad green valley of Virginia stretching off to the Allegheny Mountains to the west and lazy pastoral Piedmont to the east. So here, each time we hauled ourselves to a mountaintop and stepped onto a rocky overlook, instead of seeing nothing but endless tufted green mountains stretching to the horizon, we got airy views of a real, lived-in world. Sunny farms, clustered hamlets, clumps of woodland and winding highways, all made exquisitely picturesque by distance. Even an interstate highway, with its cloverleaf interchanges and parallel roadways, looked benign and thoughtful, like the illustrations you used to get in children's books in my boyhood, showing an America that was busy and on the move, but not too busy to be attractive. We walked for a week and hardly saw a soul. One afternoon I met a man who had been section hiking for 25 years with a bicycle and a car. Each morning he would drop the bike at a finishing point 10 miles or so down the trail, drive the car back to the start, hike between the two, and cycle back to his car. He did this for 2 weeks every April, and figured he had about another 20 years to go. Another day I found an older man, lean and rangy, who looked to be well into his 70s. He had a small, old-fashioned day pack of tawny canvas, and moved with extraordinary swiftness. 2 or 3 times an hour I would sight him just ahead, 50 or 60 yards away, vanishing into the trees. Though he moved much faster than I did, and never seemed to rest, he was always there. Wherever there was 50 or 60 yards of view, there he would be, just the back of him, just disappearing. It was like following a ghost. I tried to catch up and couldn't. He never looked at me that I could see, but I was sure he was aware of me behind him. You get kind of a sixth sense for the presence of others in the woods, and when you realize people are near, you always pause to let them catch up, just to exchange pleasantries and say hello, and maybe find out if anyone has heard a weather forecast. But the man ahead never paused, never varied his pace, never looked back. In the late afternoon he vanished, and I never saw him again. In the evening, I told Katz about it. "Jesus," he muttered privately. "Now he's hallucinating on me." But the next day Katz saw him all day, behind him, following, always near but never overtaking. It was very weird. After that, neither of us saw him again. We didn't see anyone. In consequence, we had shelters to ourselves each night, which was a big treat. You know your life has grown pathetic when you're thrilled to have a covered wooden platform to call your own, but there you are. We were thrilled. The shelters along this section of trail were mostly new and spanking clean. Several were even provisioned with a broom, a cozy domestic touch. Moreover, the brooms were used, we used them, and whistled while we did it, proving that if you give an AT hiker an appliance of comfort, he will use it responsibly. Each shelter had a nearby privy, a good water source, and a picnic table so we could prepare and eat our meals in a more or less normal posture instead of squatting on damp logs. All of these are great luxuries on the trail. On the fourth night, just as I was facing the dismal prospect of finishing my only book, and thereafter having nothing to do in the evenings but lie in the half-light and listen to Kat's snore, I was delighted, thrilled, sublimely gratified to find that some earlier user had left a Graham Greene paperback. If there is one thing the AT teaches, it is low-level ecstasy, something we could all do with more of in our lives. So I was happy. We were doing 15 or 16 miles a day, nothing like the 25 miles we had been promised we would do, but still a perfectly respectable distance by our lights. I felt springy and fit, and for the first time in years had a stomach that didn't look like a ball bag. I was still weary and stiff at the end of the day, that never stopped, but I had reached the point where aches and blisters were so central a feature of my existence that I ceased to notice them. Each time you leave the cosseted and hygienic world of towns and take yourself into the hills, you go through a series of staged transformations, a kind of gentle descent into squalor. And each time, it is as if you have never done it before. At the end of the first day, you feel mildly, self-consciously grubby. By the second day, disgustingly so. By the third, you are beyond caring. By the fourth, you have forgotten what it is like not to be like this. Hunger, too, follows a defined pattern. On the first night, you're starving for your noodles. On the second night, you're starving, but wish it wasn't noodles. On the third, you don't want the noodles, but know you had better eat something. By the fourth, you have no appetite at all, but just eat because that is what you do at this time of day. I can't explain it, but it's strangely agreeable. And then something happens to make you realize how much, how immeasurably much, you want to revisit the real world. On our sixth night, after a long day of uncharacteristically dense woods, we emerged towards evening at a small grassy clearing on a high bluff, with a long, sensational, unobstructed view to the north and west. The sun was just falling behind the distant blue-gray Allegheny Ridge, and the country between, a plain of broad, orderly farms, each with a clump of trees and a farmhouse, was just at that point where it was beginning to drain of color. But the feature that made us gawk was a town, a real town, the first we had seen in a week, that stood perhaps 6 or 7 miles to the north. From where we stood, we could just make out what were clearly the large, brightly lit and colored signs of roadside restaurants and big motels. I don't think I have ever seen anything that looked half so beautiful, a quarter so tantalizing. I would almost swear to you I could smell the aroma of grilling steaks wafting up to us on the evening air. We stared at it for ages, as if it were something we had read about in books but had never expected to see. "Waynesboro," I said to Katz at last. He nodded solemnly. "How far?" I pulled out my map and had a look. "About 8 miles by trail." He nodded solemnly again. "Good," he said. It was, I realized, the longest conversation we had had in 2 or 3 days, but there was no need to say anything more. We had been a week on the trail, and were going to town the next day. That was self-evident. We would hike 8 miles, get a room, have a shower, phone home, do laundry, eat dinner, buy groceries, watch TV, sleep in a bed, eat breakfast, return to the trail. All this was known and obvious. Everything we did was known and obvious. It was wonderful, really. So we pitched our tents and fixed noodles with the last of our water, then sat side by side on a log, eating in silence, facing Waynesboro. A full moon rose in the pale evening sky, and glowed with a rich white inner light that brought to mind, but perfectly, the creamy inside of an Oreo cookie. Eventually on the trail, everything reminds you of food. After a long period of silence, I turned to Katz and asked him abruptly, in a tone that was hopeful rather than accusatory, "Do you know how to make anything besides noodles?" I had been thinking, I guess, about resupplying the next day. He thought about this for a good while. "French toast," he said at last, and grew silent for a long period before inclining his head towards me very slightly and saying, "You?" "No," I said at length. "Nothing." Katz considered the implications of this, looked for a moment as if he might say something, then shook his head stoically and returned to his dinner. Chapter 11. Now here's a thought to consider. Every 20 minutes on the Appalachian Trail, Katz and I walked farther than the average American walks in a week. For 93% of all trips outside the home, for whatever distance or whatever purpose, Americans now get in a car. On average, the total walking of an American these days, that's walking of all types, from car to office, from office to car, around the supermarket and shopping malls, adds up to 1.4 miles a week, barely 350 yards a day. That's ridiculous. When my family and I moved to the States, one of the things we wanted was to live in a traditional small town, the sort of place where Jimmy Stewart would be the mayor, the Hardy Boys would deliver your groceries, and Deanna Durbin would forever be singing at an open window. Perfect little towns are not easy to find, of course, but Hanover, where we settled, comes close. It is a small, typical New England college town, pleasant, sedate, and compact, full of old trees and sunny steeples. It has a broad green, an old-fashioned main street, a handsome campus with a settled and venerable air, and leafy residential streets. Nearly everyone in town is within a level, easy stroll of the post office, library, and stores. But here's the thing. Hardly anyone, as far as I can tell, walks anywhere for anything. I know a man who drives 600 yards to work. I know a woman who gets in her car to go a quarter of a mile to a college gymnasium to walk on a treadmill, then complains passionately about the difficulty of finding a parking space. When I asked her once why she didn't walk to the gym and do 5 minutes less on the treadmill, she looked at me as if I were being willfully provocative. "Because I have a program for the treadmill," she explained. "It records my distance and speed, and I can adjust it for degree of difficulty." It hadn't occurred to me how thoughtlessly deficient nature is in this regard. At least in Hanover she could walk if she wanted to. In many places in America now, it is not actually possible to be a pedestrian, even if you want to be. I had this brought home to me the next day in Waynesboro, after we had gotten a room and treated ourselves to an extravagant late breakfast. I left Katz at a laundromat. He loved doing laundry for some reason. Loved to read the tattered magazines and experience the miracle of stiff, disgusting clothes emerging from big machines fluffed and sweet-smelling. And set off to find some insect repellent for us. Waynesboro had a traditional, vaguely pleasant central business district, covering 5 or 6 square blocks. But, as so often these days, most retail businesses had moved out to shopping centers on the periphery, leaving little but a sprinkling of banks, insurance offices, and dusty thrift stores or second-hand shops in what presumably was once a thriving downtown. Lots of shops were dark and bare. Nowhere could I find a store at which to get insect repellent. A man outside the post office suggested I try Kmart. "Where's your car?" he said, preparatory to giving directions. "I don't have a car." That stopped him. "Really? It's over a mile, I'm afraid." "That's okay." He gave his head a little dubious shake, as if disowning responsibility for what he was about to tell me. "Well, then what you want to do is go up Broad Street, take a ride at the Burger King, keep on going. But you know, when I think about it, it's well over a mile, maybe a mile and a half, mile and three quarters. You walking back as well?"
"Yeah."
Another shake.
"Long way."
"I'll take emergency provisions." If he realized this was a joke, he didn't show it.
"Well, good luck to you,"
he said.
"Thank you. You know, there's a cab company around the corner,"
he offered helpfully, as an afterthought. "I actually prefer to walk," I explained. He nodded uncertainly.
"Well, good luck to you," he said again.
So I walked. It was a warm afternoon, and it felt wonderful. You can't believe how wonderful. To be at large without a pack, bouncy and unburdened. With a pack, you walk with a tilt, hunched and pressed forward, your eyes on the ground. You trudge. It is all you can do. Without, you are liberated. You walk erect. You look around. You spring. You saunter. You amble. Or at least you do for 4 blocks. Then you come to a mad junction at Burger King and discover that the new 6-lane road to Kmart is long, straight, very busy, and entirely without facilities for pedestrians. No sidewalks, no pedestrian crossings, no central refuges, no buttons to push for a walk sign at lively intersections. I walk through gas station and motel forecourts, and across restaurant parking lots, clambered over concrete barriers, crossed lawns, and pushed through neglected ranks of privet or honeysuckle at property boundaries, at bridges over creeks and culverts, and goodness me how developers love a culvert. I had no choice but to walk on the road, pressed against the dusty railings and causing less attentive cars to swerve to avoid me. 4 times I was honked at for having the temerity to proceed through town without benefit of metal. One bridge was so patently dangerous that I hesitated at it. The creek it crossed was only a reedy trickle, narrow enough to step across, so I decided to go that way. I slid and scampered down the bank, found myself in a hidden zone of sucking gray mud, pitched over 2 times, hauled myself up the other side, pitched over again, and emerged at length, streaked and speckled with mud and extravagantly decorated with burrs. When I finally reached the Kmart Plaza, I discovered that I was on the wrong side of the road and had to dash through 6 lanes of hostile traffic. By the time I crossed the parking lot and stepped into the air-conditioned, Muzak-happy world of Kmart, I was as grubby as if I'd been on the trail and trembling all over. The Kmart, it turned out, didn't stock insect repellent. So I turned around and set off back to town. But this time, in a burst of madness I don't even want to go into, I headed home, cross-country, over farm fields and through a zone of light industry. I tore my jeans on barbed wire and got muddier still. When finally I got back to town, I found Kat sitting in the sun on a metal chair on the motel lawn, freshly showered, dressed in newly laundered attire, and looking intensely happy in a way that only a hiker can look when he is in a town at ease. Technically, he was waxing his boots, but really he was just sitting, watching the world go by, and dreamily enjoying the sunshine. He greeted me warmly. Katz was always a new man in town.
"Good Lord, look at you," he cried, delighted at my grubbiness. "What have you been doing? You're filthy."
He looked me up and down admiringly, then said in a more solemn tone,
"You haven't been screwing hogs again, have you, Bryson?"
"Ha, ha, ha.
They're not clean animals, you know, no matter how attractive they may look after a month on the trail. And don't forget we're not in Tennessee anymore. It's probably not even legal here, at least not without a note from the vet."
He patted the chair beside him, beaming all over, happy with his quips.
"Come and sit down and tell me all about it. So what was her name, Bossy?"
He leaned closely and confidentially.
"Did she squeal a lot?"
I sat in the chair. "You're only jealous."
"Well, as a matter of fact, I'm not. I made a friend of my own today, at the laundromat. Her name's Beulah."
"Beulah? You're joking."
"I may wish I was, but it's a fact."
"Nobody's named Beulah."
"Well, she is. And real nice, too. Not real smart, but real nice, with cute little dimples just here."
He poked his cheeks to show me where.
"And she has a terrific body."
"Oh, yes?" He nodded.
"Of course," he added judiciously. "It's buried under 220 pounds of wobbling fat. Fortunately, I don't mind size in a woman as long as, you know, you don't have to remove a wall or anything to get her out of the house."
He gave his boot a thoughtful swipe. "So, how did you meet her?"
"As a matter of fact," he said,
sitting forward keenly, as if this was a story worth telling,
"she asked me to come and look at her panties."
I nodded. "Of course."
"They'd got caught in the washing machine agitator," he explained.
"And she was wearing them at the time? You said she wasn't real smart."
"No, she was washing them, and the elastic got stuck in the spindle thing, and she asked me to come and help extract them. Big panties," he added thoughtfully, and fell into a brief reverie at the memory of it, then continued, "I got 'em out, but they were shredded all to hell, so I said, kind of droll-like, 'Well, miss, I sure hope you've got another pair, because these are shredded all to hell.'"
"Oh, Stephen, the wit!"
"It'll do for Waynesboro, believe me." "And she said, 'Now here's the thing, my grubby hog-humping friend.' She said, 'Well, wouldn't you like to know, honey?'"
He made his eyebrows bounce.
"I'm meeting her at 7 outside the fire station."
"What, she keeps her spare underpants there?" He gave me an exasperated look.
"No, it's just a place to meet. We're going to Papa John's Pizza for dinner, and then, with any luck, we'll do what you've been doing all day. Only I won't have to climb a fence and lure her with alfalfa. Well, I hope not, anyway. Hey, look at this," he said, and reached down to a paper bag at his feet.
He brought out a pair of pink female underwear that could fairly be called capacious.
"I thought I'd give them to her. As a kind of joke, you understand?"
"In a restaurant? Are you sure that's a good idea?"
discreetly, you know. I held up the underpants with outstretched arms. They really were quite arrestingly jumbo-sized.
If she doesn't like them, you can always use them as a ground sheet.
Are these, I have to ask, are these this big as part of the joke, or...
Oh, she's a big woman,
Kat said, and bounced his eyebrows again happily. He put the pants neatly, reverently back in the bag.
Big woman.
So I dined alone at a place called the Coffee Mill Restaurant. It felt a little odd to be without cats after so many days of constant companionship, but agreeable as well, for the same reason. I was eating a steak dinner, my book propped against a sugar shaker, entirely content, when I glanced up to find Kat stalking towards me across the restaurant, looking alarmed and furtive.
"Thank God I found you," he said, and took a seat opposite me in the booth. He was sweating freely. "There's some guy looking for me."
"What are you talking about?"
"Beulah's husband."
"Beulah has a husband?"
"I know. It's a miracle. There can't be more than two people on the planet who'd be willing to sleep with her, and here we are both in the same town."
This was all going too fast for me. "I don't understand. What happened?"
"I was standing outside the fire station, you know, like we'd agreed, and a red pickup truck screeches to a stop, and this guy gets out looking real angry and saying he's Beulah's old man and he wants to talk to me."
"So what did you do?"
"I ran. What do you think?"
"And he didn't catch you?"
"He weighed about 600 pounds. He wasn't exactly the sprinting type. More the shoot-your-balls-off type. He's been cruising around for a half hour looking for me. I've been running through backyards and crashing into clotheslines and all kinds of shit. I ended up with some other guy chasing me because he thought I was a prowler. What the hell am I supposed to do now, Bryson?"
"Okay. First, you stop talking to fat ladies in laundromats.
Yeah.
Then I go out of here, see if the coast is clear, and give you a signal from the window."
"Yeah. And then?"
"Then you walk very briskly back to the motel with your hands over your balls and hope this guy doesn't spot you." He was quiet a moment.
"That's it? That's your best plan? That's your very best plan?"
"Have you got a better one?"
"No. But I didn't go to college for 4 years.
Stephen, I didn't study how to save your ass in Waynesboro. I majored in political science. If your problem was to do with proportional representation in Switzerland, I might be able to help you." He sighed and sat back heavily with his arms crossed, bleakly considering his position and how he'd gotten himself into this fix.
"You don't let me talk to any women again, of any size, at least until we get out of the Confederacy. These guys have all got guns down here. You promise?"
"Oh, it's a promise." He sat in edgy silence while I finished my dinner, swiveling his head to check out all the windows, expecting to see a fat, angry face pressed against the glass. When I had finished and paid the bill, we went to the door.
"I could be dead in a minute,"
he said grimly, then clutched my forearm.
"Look, if I get shot, do me a favor. Call my brother and tell him there's $10,000 buried in a coffee can under his front lawn."
"You buried $10,000 under your brother's front lawn?"
"No, of course not. But he's a little prick and it would serve him right. Let's go."
I stepped outside and the street was clear, completely empty of traffic. Waynesboro was at home, in front of the TV. I gave him a nod. His head came out, looked cautiously left and right, and he tore off down the street at a rate that was, all things considered, astounding. It took me 2 or 3 minutes to stroll to the motel. I didn't see anyone. At the motel, I knocked on his door. Instantly, a preposterously deep, authoritative voice said,
"Who is it?"
I sighed. "Bubba T. Flubba. I want to talk to you, boy."
"Bryson, don't fuck around. I can see you through the peephole."
"Then why are you asking who it is?"
"Practicing."
I waited a minute. "Are you going to let me in?"
"Can't. I got a chest of drawers in front of the door."
"Are you serious?"
"Go to your room and I'll call you."
My room was next door, but the phone was already ringing when I got there. Katz wanted every detail of my walk home,
and had elaborate plans for his defense involving a heavy ceramic lamp base and, ultimately, escape out the back window. My role was to create a diversion, ideally by setting the man's truck alight, then running in a contrary direction. Twice more in the night, once just after midnight, he called me to tell me that he had seen a red pickup truck cruising the streets. In the morning, he refused to go out for breakfast. So I went to the supermarket for groceries and brought us both a bag of food from Hardee's. He wouldn't leave the room until the cab was waiting by the motel office with the motor running. It was 4 miles back to the trail. He looked out the back window the whole way. The cab dropped us at Rockfish Gap, southern gateway to Shenandoah National Park, our last long stretch of hiking before we ended part one of our big adventure. We had allotted 6.5 weeks for this initial foray, and now it was nearly over. I was ready for a vacation. We both were, goodness knows. And I longed to see my family, beyond my power to convey. Even so, I was looking forward to what I hoped would be a climactic amble. Shenandoah National Park, 101 miles from top to bottom, is famously beautiful, and I was eager to see it at last. We had, after all, walked a long way to get here. At Rockfish Gap, there is a toll booth manned by rangers where motorists have to pay an entrance fee, and thru-hikers have to acquire a backcountry hiking permit. The permit doesn't cost anything. One of the noblest traditions of the Appalachian Trail is that every inch of it is free. But you have to complete a lengthy form giving your personal details, your itinerary through the park, and where you plan to camp each night, which is a little ridiculous because you haven't seen the terrain and don't know what kind of mileage you might achieve. Appended to the form were the usual copious regulations and warnings of severe fines and immediate banishment for doing, well, pretty much anything. I filled out the form the best I could and handed it in at the window to a lady ranger.
"So you're hiking the trail,"
she said brightly, if not terribly astutely, accepted the form without looking at it, banged it severely with rubber stamps, and tore off the part that would serve as our license to walk on land that, in theory, we owned anyway. "Well, we're trying," I said.
"I must get up there myself one of these days. I hear it's real nice."
This took me aback. "You've never been on the trail?" "But you're a ranger," I wanted to say.
"No, afraid not," she answered wistfully. "Lived here all my life, but haven't gotten to it yet. One day I will."
Katz, mindful of Beulah's husband, was practically dragging me towards the safety of the woods, but I was curious.
"How long have you been a ranger?" I called back.
12 years in August," she said proudly.
"You ought to give it a try sometime. It's real nice."
"Might get some of that flab off your butt," Katz muttered privately, and stepped into the woods. I looked at him with interest and surprise. It wasn't like Katz to be so uncharitable, and put it down to lack of sleep, profound sexual frustration, and a surfeit of Hardee's sausage biscuits. Shenandoah National Park is a park with problems. More even than the Smokies, it suffers from a chronic shortage, though a cynic might say a chronic misapplication, of funds. Several miles of side trails have been closed, and others are deteriorating. If it weren't that volunteers from the Potomac Appalachian Trail Club maintain 80% of the park's trails, including the whole of the AT through the park, the situation would be much worse. Matthews Arm Campground, one of the park's main recreational areas, was closed for lack of funds in 1993 and hasn't been opened since. Several other recreation areas are closed for most of the year. For a time in the 1980s, even the trail shelters, or huts as they are known here, were shut. I don't know how they did it. I mean to say, how exactly do you close a wooden structure with a 15-foot-wide opening at the front? And still less, why? Since forbidding hikers from resting for a few hours on a wooden sleeping platform is hardly going to transform the park's finances. But then, making things difficult for hikers is something of a tradition in the eastern parks. A couple of months earlier, all the national parks, along with all other non-essential government departments, had been closed for a couple of weeks during a budget impasse between President Clinton and Congress. Yet Shenandoah, despite its perennial want of money, found the funds to post a warden at each AT access point to turn back all thru-hikers. In consequence, a couple of dozen harmless people had to make lengthy, pointless detours by road before they could resume their long hike. This vigilance couldn't have cost the Park Service less than $20,000, or the better part of $1,000 for each dangerous thru-hiker deflected. On top of its self-generated shortcomings, Shenandoah has a lot of problems arising from factors largely beyond its control. Overcrowding is one. Although the park is over 100 miles long, it is almost nowhere more than a mile or two wide, so all its 2 million annual visitors are crowded into a singularly narrow corridor along the ridgeline. Campgrounds, visitor centers, parking lots, picnic sites, the AT, and Skyline Drive, the scenic road that runs down the spine of the park. All exist cheek by jowl. One of the most popular non-AT hiking routes in the park, up Old Rag Mountain, has become so much in demand that on summer weekends people sometimes have to queue to get on it. Then there is the vexed matter of pollution. 30 years ago it was still possible on especially clear days to see the Washington Monument 75 miles away. Now, on hot, smoggy summer days, visibility can be as little as 2 miles, and never more than 30. Acid rain in the streams has nearly wiped out the park's trout. Gypsy moths arrived in 1983, and have since ravaged considerable acreages of oaks and hickories. The southern pine beetle has done similar work on conifers, and the locust leaf miner has inflicted disfiguring, but mercifully, usually non-fatal, damage on thousands of locust trees. In just 7 years, the woolly adelgid has fatally damaged more than 90% of the park's hemlocks. Nearly all the rest will be dying by the time you read this. An untreatable fungal disease called anthracnose is wiping out the lovely dogwoods, not just here, but everywhere in America. Before long, the dogwood, like the American chestnut and American elm, will effectively cease to exist. It would be hard, in short, to conceive a more stressed environment. And yet, here's the thing. Shenandoah National Park is lovely. It is possibly the most wonderful national park I have ever been in, and, considering the impossible and conflicting demands put on it, it is extremely well run. Almost at once it became my favorite part of the Appalachian Trail. We hike through deep-seeming woods, along gloriously untaxing terrain, climbing a gentle 500 feet in 4 miles. In the Smokies, you can climb 500 feet in, well, about 500 feet. This was more like it. The weather was kindly, and there was a real sense of spring being on the turn. And there was life everywhere. Zumming insects, squirrels scampering along boughs, birds twittering and hopping about, spider webs gleaming silver in the sun. Twice I flushed grouse, always a terrifying experience. An instantaneous explosion from the undergrowth at your feet, like bald socks fired from a gun, followed by drifting feathers and a lingering residue of fussy, bitching noise. I saw an owl, which watched me imperturbably from a nearby stout limb, and loads of deer which raised their heads to stare, but otherwise seemed fearless, and casually returned to their browsing when I had passed. 60 years ago there were no deer in this neck of the Blue Ridge Mountains. They had been hunted out of existence. Then, after the park was created in 1936, 13 white-tailed deer were introduced, and with no one to hunt them and few predators, they thrived. Today there are 5,000 deer in the park, all descended from those original 13, or others that migrated from nearby. Surprisingly, considering its modest dimensions and how little room there is for real backcountry, the park is remarkably rich in wildlife. Bobcats, bears, red and gray foxes, beaver, skunks, raccoons, flying squirrels, and our friends the salamanders exist in admirable numbers, though you don't often see them, as most are nocturnal or wary of people. Shenandoah is said to have the highest density of black bears anywhere in the world, slightly over 1 per square mile. There have even been reported sightings, including by park rangers, who perhaps ought to know better, of mountain lions, even though mountain lions haven't been confirmed in the eastern woods for almost 70 years. There is the tiniest chance that they may exist in pockets in the northern woods. We shall get to that in due course, and I think you'll be glad you waited. But not in an area as small and hemmed in as Shenandoah National Park.